to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Welcome to the Faculty Book Review. Today's interview is with Daniel Markovitz, Yale Law School Professor of Law. Professor Markovitz discusses in his new book, A Modern Legal Ethics, Adversary Advocacy in a Democratic Age. In his new book, Professor Markovitz reinterprets the positive law governing lawyers to identify fidelity as its organizing ideal. Professor Markovitz is interviewed by Jan Conroy, Director of Public Affairs at the Yale Law School.
Welcome, Professor Markovitz.
Thanks very much. It's a delight that you're doing this.
Can you tell us a little bit about your new book? How did you become interested in legal ethics?
Sure. I'm not actually principally or directly a legal ethicist. I'm really interested in what I call the four pillars of liberal legalism, which are the four sets of institutions through which open, complex, cosmopolitan legal orders manage to sustain social legitimacy and political stability. And I think that they are democracy, markets, adjudication, and then something like freedom of conscience or toleration as a limiting condition on the other three. And I'm interested in legal ethics because I'm interested in the structure of adjudication and the way in which lawyers are the sort of foot soldiers of the system of adjudication. And that's especially true in an adjudicatory system like ours, where by ours I mean the United States, but also the broader common law tradition, in which a great many disputes are taken out of bureaucratic forms of social ordering and shunted into adjudication, court-based dispute resolution. And it's doubly true in the United States, where in fact the overwhelming majority of disputes never actually get to court, so that whatever services adjudication provides disputants, it provides through lawyers, not through judges and juries.
What is distinctive in your approach to legal ethics?
So I think two things are distinctive. The first is directly connected to what I just said, which is that I'm interested in legal ethics not as a branch of purely professional morality, or even morality more generally, but in light of the connection between what lawyers do and problems that are distinctively political. So let me just be concrete. Traditional legal ethics thought of the law as a freestanding, or the lawyering, the practice of law, as a freestanding moral practice, and asked, what is it that lawyers think lawyers ought to do? A revisionist tradition, which is associated, say, most famously these days with the work of David Luban, emphasized that lawyering isn't isolated from the rest of morality, that lawyers are people too, and asked, what should lawyers do by answering, what should a person do who happens to be in the position that a lawyer is in, observing that the lawyer's role can't insulate her from the demands of morality? I think that's perfectly true, but I also think that lawyers play a distinctive role in our political order. And by that I mean they play a role in the way in which we resolve disputes among people, recognizing that they'll disagree about matters of morality. And we have a distinctive set of political institutions which take people's distinct moral points of view, put them together, and find a way to strike a resolution that's acceptable to everyone. So that's why adjudication is one of the core pillars of liberal legalism. And it seems to me that legal ethics should be approached with an eye always on this feature of adjudication. I think there's a second respect in which my approach to legal ethics is distinctive, which is methodological rather than substantive. It's related to substance, though. People who are interested in legal ethics as a special case of morality try to figure out how it is that lawyers face the kinds of moral dilemmas that one can imagine people facing without knowing anything about what lawyers do. When they face dilemmas between some obligation to keep a secret and some great interest of someone else. These are the cases in which, say, a lawyer knows where her client has buried the bodies of someone whom she's murdered. I think those are interesting cases, but they're not as interesting for my purposes. Because remember, I'm interested in lawyers as exemplars of a broader practice, and if the practice, in terms of its position in the whole range of political practices that we have. And what that means is there are two features of my work that are different from what others have done. The first is that I'm interested not so much in criticizing or reforming legal ethics as I am in interpreting it and trying to understand what are the immanent ideals of the practice of law as we know it, and how do those ideals fit into our other political and moral practices. So I'm interpreting rather than correcting, in a way. And the second is related to the first, which is that if you're interested in interpreting, if you want to know what a practice is really like, you should try to ask what the practice is ordinarily like, not what it's like in extreme cases. So rather than focusing on cases in which, say, the lawyer knows where her client has buried the bodies, I focus on the much more banal, but much more common and much more important case, in which the lawyer simply believes that on balance her client is in the wrong. So imagine a lawyer representing the owner of a building in a simple tort case. The issue is whether the owner has adequately lighted a stairwell in which the plaintiff fell. The lawyer concludes, following her own investigation, that the stairwell was not adequately lighted. Nevertheless, she has to argue in court as part of the defense of her client that the stairwell was adequately lighted. Now, mind you, it's not that she thinks that the client is lying or that it would be totally unreasonable to conclude that the stairwell was adequately lighted. It's just that she thinks on balance it was too dark. So she's now put in the position of having to make arguments that she herself believes are false in the service of a cause that she herself believes is not justified. And I'm interested in the question, what is the social role of having people who are specialists in doing that? And also, what's it like ethically to be a lawyer doing those sorts of things?
What, in your view, are the central principles of lawyers' professional ethics? Do they equip lawyers to lead society in the pursuit of justice?
So I think there are two basic principles of legal ethics. The first is an ideal that I call fidelity. And by fidelity, I mean not just loyalty in the traditional sense, but also fidelity in the sense of high fidelity, as in high fidelity sound equipment. That is to say, the ability accurately and generously to translate what clients have said to them into a language that the legal system can understand and engage with. Fidelity, I think, is essential for reasons that are connected to what I said right at the beginning of this discussion, which is that lawyers in the common law, and particularly in our legal system, are the principal interface between the state and disputants. And what that means is that in order for the state to be able to engage disputants on terms that are meaningful for the people in the dispute, there has to be some instrument that translates the feelings of hurt and demand that the disputants have into a language that the state can address, and then translates the state's answers back into a language that the disputants can receive. And in order to do that, lawyers must be loyal to the disputants rather than to the state. If they were loyal to the state, then they would simply be the state from the perspective of the disputants. There would be no interface. And moreover, they have to be able accurately to translate what the disputants say into a language that the state can understand. Let me just give a very particular example to render this more vivid. Somebody negligently drives a car. And as a result of the negligence, or let's say even recklessness of the driver, someone else is hurt, loses a limb in an auto accident. The victim is going to feel many things. She'll be upset. She'll be angry. She might seek revenge. She might want punishment. All these are natural human emotions and responses to the fact that someone else has been careless, and careless in a way that has dramatically reduced one's own life circumstances. The legal system, on the other hand, isn't prepared to deliver almost any of those things. Instead, the legal system is prepared to deliver money damages. Now, if you ask somebody in advance, would you be willing to be paid some sum of money, even a large sum of money, in exchange for letting somebody else carelessly cut off your leg, everybody would say no and think, moreover, that's insulting. It would make it worse, not better. So what you have is a person who has natural feelings of hurt in the dispute, and a legal system that is not structured to address those feelings directly. And yet, in our system, most tort victims, especially when they win their lawsuits, come away feeling as though they got what they were entitled to. And that's an amazing thing. How is it that a money damage payment that is obviously inadequate at the beginning of the dispute becomes satisfactory at the end? The answer, I think, is that the process of dispute resolution is one that causes the disputants themselves to come to internalize its norms and values. And lawyers, when they display fidelity to their clients, help with that process of internalization. So fidelity is the first virtue, and that's the other regarding virtue associated with lawyers. The second core feature of legal ethics, the core principle, is something I call negative capability. And I borrow that idea actually from John Keats, the poet, who thought poets were also what he called negatively capable, by which he means, and I mean, it's the ability to suppress one's own beliefs, judgments, attitudes, and one's natural desire to reach conclusions in the service of giving expressions to the beliefs, judgments, and attitudes of others, and withholding judgment so that one can speak for them. And you can see that in order to display fidelity, as I've characterized it, lawyers must also achieve negative capability. Negative capability, though, is a very costly thing to achieve because it means that one's engaged professionally, if one's a lawyer, in the business of suppressing or even betraying one's own ordinary beliefs and ideals. And so to be a negatively capable lawyer is to internalize a kind of threat to one's own integrity, to open oneself up to the influences of others in a way that causes one to betray oneself. To be very concrete, to go back to the slip and fall case in the stairwell that I described earlier, the lawyer, in order to broadcast, project, speak her client's ideas and beliefs, has to suppress her own view that the client, in fact, was negligent, didn't maintain the stairwell, and doesn't deserve to win. She has to, in a way, lie and cheat. She's saying things that she thinks are false in the service of a cause that she thinks is unjust. It's very difficult as a person to take on a professional role which requires that kind of systematic and regular self-betrayal. And one of the signal problems with legal ethics, or for legal ethics, is to figure out how the legal profession can be structured so that lawyers can successfully inhabit that role. That is to say, even as they betray their own personal beliefs in the service of fidelity and negative capability, they can nevertheless view their professional lives from the inside as lives that they affirm and would like to claim authorship of.
What do you think is the relationship between distinctively legal ethics and modern ethical life more generally?
So I think that the last thing I said helps to show what the relationship is. Here's a way to think about this. The basic idea of modern morality is the idea of impartiality or impersonality. This is the idea that other people are freestanding sources of moral claims on each of us, and that everyone's life is as important as everyone else's, including our own, so that we can't prefer ourselves over others unless we do so for reasons that others can accept. But there's a second idea in ethics that's much older, that's associated with Aristotle, that hasn't gone away, although modernity has made it much more difficult to embrace, which is the idea that ethics or morality isn't to be measured in the currency of self-sacrifice. It isn't about the demands that others make on oneself, but rather ethics is what Bernard Williams once called an enabling device in the agent's own life. Or to put it even more briefly, that ethics is the science of doing well by doing good. So the idea for ethics is to form appropriate ambitions and then to achieve them. Now, the idea, the modern view, that ethics is about self-sacrifice puts everyone in modernity in the position of having a hard time achieving this other, older ethical idea, the idea of doing well by doing good, because the modern idea suggests that often doing good requires us not to do well, not to flourish. That's true generally. It's made even more true by the fact that complex modern societies inevitably require all of their members to have only a partial view of what impartiality requires. We don't approach humanity from the perspective of the universe. Instead, we approach it as citizens of a particular state, employees of a particular firm, members of particular families, residents in particular communities. And in each case, our loyalties to these more narrow, small-gauge units come into conflict with the demands of impartiality. Just to take an example that's alive in the news today, as American citizens, we're faced now with the fact that because of the economic crisis, many of our fellow citizens are suffering terribly. They're losing their jobs. They don't have enough money to heat their homes. In many cases, they don't have health care. At the same time, it's true that many more people elsewhere in the world are suffering much, much more terribly in conditions of famine or war or genocide. From the point of view of humanity, it's the foreigners' claims that are much more pressing on us than those of our own fellow citizens. But from the point of view of citizenship, it's the claims of our fellow citizens that are more pressing on us. So we're faced in with a situation as citizens, and as Americans, we're no distinct from others, and if it weren't citizenship, it'd be membership in a family or a firm or something else, of having to decide how we can balance the local duties associated with our own peculiar circumstances and our own personal ambitions with the global duties of all humanity. Lawyers are in exactly that position. It's just it's more vivid for them, because the lawyer's particular set of local duties require them to abandon their judgment of the global duties they have to all humanity in the service of their judgments of how they'll best serve their clients. That's what fidelity and negative capability are. So the same kind of ethical dilemma that characterizes everyone in modernity is made into sort of a self-conscious governing or regulatory principle for the lawyer's ethical life. And in that way, lawyers are sort of miners' canaries for the modern ethical condition. And the tensions they face are just extreme, clear-eyed, well-theorized versions of the tensions that we all face. And that's the sense in which legal ethics really is a good window into modern ethical life more broadly.
Professor Markovitz, can you talk a little bit about what implications your book would have for legal or moral education?
Yeah, so look, if the diagnosis that I've just outlined of the lawyer's ethical condition or of all of our ethical condition is correct, that is to say, if we're all stuck in this tension between wishing to live a life that can honorably vindicate our own personal peculiar attachments and live a life that can treat all of humanity as impartiality requires, then the solution has got to be to find a way to reconstruct our personal attachments, the roles we play, like citizenship or employeeship in a firm or professorship at a university, that can reconstruct those roles so that they become compatible with the demands that impartiality places on us. And there are two elements to that. One is to make the roles so that they don't place demands on us that impartiality can't acknowledge. So if citizenship comes to require us to promote, let's say, to take another concrete case, America's energy independence at the cost of respecting human rights in the Middle East, then there's a problem with citizenship. And the positive demands of citizenship have to be altered. And one thing you can see lawyers struggle with is to figure out how to balance the professional ethics of lawyers as lawyers against the general idea that people who have the skills that lawyers have ought to promote justice and not just their clients' peculiar interests. So that's one way in which my view gives some purchase on core problems of moral or legal education. But there's another, and I think deeper, way in which the view is relevant to these questions, which is it's not just a question of substance, it's also a question of form. That is to say, how is it that we can reconstruct our peculiar ambitions so that they seem to us like the kind of ambitions we might appropriately have, even given that we're also citizens of the world? Let me give you an analogy from another realm of ethics. Late in the 19th century and running into the 20th century, the relationships between men and women, particularly surrounding marriage, were changed dramatically. And here is a way to think about what happened. You had a growing realization in the moral and political order of the fundamental equality of women. But you had an institution, traditional marriage, which was based both juridically and in its lived experience on the inequality of women. And so what had to happen is what it meant to be in a marriage had to be reimagined so that one could be married and yet still live a life that was consistent with the basic equality of women. The great invention was companionate marriage. Now, a similar thing may be happening to marriage now if current trends go forward, which is very much to be hoped. We may be again reimagining marriage and family life so that it becomes compatible with the fundamental equality of all persons regardless of their sexual identities. But again, to achieve that, you have to reimagine what the institution and relationship is. Similarly, if we're going to render personal attachments compatible with moral impartiality, we have to reimagine the nature of personal attachments quite generally. What is it to be a member of a family or of an institution? What's the structure of institutional demands? How can institutions and the idea of them be renovated so that they no longer are simply examples of clannishness or caste or exclusion? And one of the things that law schools do nowadays is they try to train students so that they can enter the legal profession in a way that is consistent with the profession's impartial justification. And I think the place actually where law schools especially do that is in their clinical education, where they put students in the role of functioning as actual lawyers with duties to clients, but at the same time treat this as a teaching tool to get students to orient themselves to their future professional lives in a way that renders their professional lives compatible with their also being persons, citizens of the world, and answerable to humanity. And, you know, the book begins with the idea, it's sort of the opposite of what, you know, Marx said, philosophers have made the mistake of only trying to understand the world. The point, however, is to change it. It seems to me, actually, the first task for philosophers really is to try to understand the world. And the book begins with an effort to try to understand one feature of the world, namely, how is it that the peculiar forms of life associated with adjudication and adversary advocacy connect to the broader structures of modern moral life? If there's hope in the book of finding a way to change the world, it's not that the book gives answers or prescriptions, but that it shows the problems in a light that enables people, seeing them as they are, then to decide how best to proceed.
Is there anything else you want to add today?
Just thank you again for the opportunity to do this. It's a great kindness. I'm really delighted to have done it. Thank you.